Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester and Pete Sampson of The Athletic, rolling old school. Our esteemed colleague John Bryce has endured a cavalcade of travel delays today. He will instead try to join us next week at this time. And guys, I'm going to begin this podcast in an odd form. Question from KHuff8740, who asked, O'Malley has been saying for several podcasts he loves a good fight. Who gave him that black eye? It is not a black eye. It is a very unfortunate sty that will be alleviated at some point tomorrow. So if you're watching on TV, on a podcast, or on a Zoom forum, you can see it. If you're listening, find a screen and stare at the mutant that is.
It's not that bad.
It's not that bad, but you know, when I wore glasses trying to hide it on instant analysis, it was like just a big red eye, and I think that's what KHuff picked up.
Oh, okay. So.
Jack Freeman even said, why are you wearing glasses? And,
it didn't seem to impact your performance with Drew Mentok. So.
The funny thing about it is, Tim, I can't really see when I wear glasses close up, so I couldn't wear these today. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to see you guys or any of the questions. But we will move on from that to segment one. We talked to Marcus Freeman. We did not see practice. It's important to note. Otherwise, that would have been really good timing if we saw a full practice with Marcus Freeman. But as Pete and I mentioned walking out, that was a really informative press conference for almost midpoint of the spring. Tim, I want to get your thoughts. Drew and I were on instant analysis. Just your thoughts and some takeaways from Freeman before we get into the personnel stuff, which was great. He's not normally heavily personnel.
By the way, I love the approach that you took on that story because it was so personnel heavy. And, you know, Will Black, I guess, is the guy that comes to mind first. And talking about the number one offensive line being intact for the first six practices, which, you know, when you consider the injuries that they've had and then some of the displacement of a couple of starters a while back, that, you know, they haven't always had that continuity. I know it's just spring, but yeah, it's a good starting point. I think Will Black is slowly but surely proving that he deserves to be in the starting lineup. We haven't seen a ton of him, so I'm not, you know, validating that, but Notre Dame is by having him in the with the number one unit, with, you know, through the first six practices. So, you know, that was the first thing. I want to double down on Jordan Faison, you know, because we talked about the other day about, I think Faison's going to have a great year. And I thought the way physically he looks really, really good. And then you hear real positive things from Marcus Freeman about him. So I'm doubling down on him. And then I'm going to throw it over to Pete because he's the one that did ask the question about some of the skirmishes or scuffles or a variety of different names that are used for what we saw during the first practice. And apparently it has happened again since then. We suspect that some of that has been instigated a little bit to keep the esprit de corps going on the practice field. But, you know, he elaborated upon that, and I think it's really interesting. I mean, talking about guys squaring off in practice, you don't normally hear that spoken in a real positive way. But I get where he's coming from. It shows a lot of fight in March and now that we're in April.
Yeah, I like that he could talk about fighting in practice like a normal adult human being, because I feel like every time we talk to coaches about fights or skirmishes or Donnybrooks or melees or fisticuffs, like it's, you get this like, oh, it's a super awkward subject, and it doesn't need to be. It's football. Like every play is a fight. It's just like with between whistle to whistle. So why wouldn't that happen in practices? And I mean, I think we've all heard that Marcus loves that stuff. It's not just something that he allows. I think it's something that he encourages. And that's sort of the, I think there's an edge of a recent former player that comes through with that. I think some of it is just his personality that comes through with that. And I think guys like it. I mean, I think there are certain players, Cooper Flanagan and Don Shuler come to mind, that have been heavily involved. You know, Jordan Faison doesn't mind mixing it up. We've seen guys in the past who love doing it. So, yeah, I think there's an edge to it. But, like, on the personnel stuff, I had put together sort of a 10 most interesting players of spring practice on The Athletic this week. And I think that Freeman basically, like, validated 8 of the 10. You know, it's – I think that we know who the guys who have made a move so far. And it's not just based on what the coaches say publicly. It's what we've been – sort of being able to suss out behind the scenes. But I think, you know, the guys that Freeman mentioned yesterday, by and large, I absolutely take at face value as these are the guys who have really pushed forward during spring ball.
We often talk about how you can kind of, after you cover a coach, you can read what he's saying a little bit. And this is universal. This isn't Marcus Freeman only or Brian Kelly only, Priester. when someone asks a question about two guys and they answer about one and the other one's coming along and you start answering, listing every other player on the roster, that means one of them is coming really along and the other one is also playing that position. And that happened yesterday. I was really intrigued by Sean Steyer's question about Gilbert and Cam Williams. When I heard Gilbert, I'm like, oh man, I wouldn't have asked that question. And I heard Cam Williams, I don't think I would have thrown that in there. And he immediately answered, Micah Gilbert, injury plague 2025. I mean, we knew about the first injury. We knew there was the two broken fingers. We knew there was something else because he went from catching the touchdown against Miami to not playing all that much. I just think he's a really important player. And if Quincy Porter's healthy, and we assume he will be healthy for the season, you have a nice 1-2 punch at W. And I know it's better to have Malachi Fields than a 1-2 punch, but it's nice to have a 1-2 punch at W instead of just relying on one of those two.
Yeah, I appreciated the timing of it because I did write about Micah Gilbert yesterday, and that's a guy that I have been pinpointing here during the spring as a key man, and it will be a job share with Quincy Porter when Quincy Porter is healthy. Yeah, I think he's really, really important. You need a standout frontline W receiver that can win one-on-one battles, and the more spring goes along, the more we hear that Micah Gilbert has the ability to do that. I want to go back to the whole fight thing, because how exactly do you go about participating in a fight with another player with a helmet on? Because the guy that generally gets hurt is the one that throws the punch, not the one with the helmet on. And then I start thinking, Jason Onyeka's got a hand injury. He had a hand surgery.
Oh, no, here we go. I didn't think about that.
And I
the
look.
You're saying it, not me.
No, I'm not. I have no idea whether that's how Jason Onyeka hurt his hand. But as I'm going through this in my head, it's like, you know, a fight in basketball, a fight in baseball. You're punching. You know, you're punching the face.
Puncher wins. The puncher
yeah,
wins.
I'm not sure exactly how you go about winning a fight in football uniform and helmet. But yeah, Pete, I agree. I mean, I do think it's a little bit refreshing. That's always been kind of, you know, frowned upon. But again, injuries occur with those kind of situations, and you have to be careful. One-on-one things, and, you know, other guys can't participate in it, and it's everybody else's responsibility to break it up. It was really interesting. I didn't expect to hear him kind of embrace the whole idea of guys getting physical one-on-one with each other.
I mean, I love this. It's a new saying. We have a rule. Only two guys can fight. I think that's great. That should be a shirt. Only two guys can fight. It's better than Leave No Doubt, which I coined, by the way, and have zero royalties from the Leave No Doubt tour. And I've got nothing from Notre Dame for saying that before Marcus Freeman said it. But I'm not bitter. Yeah, these fights, Tim, it's a great point, because the one-on-one fight, you shouldn't get people hurt. We know for a fact that when there's melees in practice, people get hurt, and you don't want that if you're Marcus Freeman. I think he's seen it, and he knows he can't have it. One-on-one fights are fine because no one's going to get badly hurt. Melees happened. People have been injured. Good players, and you don't want that. But I think he's got it under control.
The other thing is you can't let it carry over into game situations. You know, you take a cheap shot from somebody that the ref doesn't see and doesn't call in a game, and then you take a swipe at somebody, you're the second man in.
Great point.
And that gets penalized. So, I mean, as long as he says, look, we can't let something like that carry over into the game, just like he says you can't let it carry over into the locker room or off the field.
Yep.
You gotta let it be a one-and-done thing on the field.
I don't know this for a fact, Pete Sampson, but I know Nolan James looks like he and Marcus Freeman and I would all like a good tunnel fight to participate in or fight. And you were on the Nolan James train early. Tim Priester was also on a Nolan James train early, but I want to throw it to you because you went and saw him in high school.
Yeah.
And you just thought, this guy looks like – he does look like he could be hard to tackle. But now, after practice six, when they first started tackling, we could prove he's hard to tackle because it was hard for them to actually tackle him.
I saw him play the night before Notre Dame played at Navy at MetLife, because I went to see Elijah Burris play, and Nolan James was his high school teammate. And I think that team had maybe two guys going to Ohio State, and then Elijah Burris and Nolan James, who was going to Boston College. And I was on the field the next day talking to somebody, and I was like, no. And I'm not saying I was like, you guys should recruit Nolan James, but I was like, are you guys looking at Nolan James at all? Like, I don't know. I mean, it seemed like there's something there. And lo and behold, they did. But he just, he was a hard guy for me to describe watching. Like, I don't know why this works. Like, he's not all that big, but he seems hard to tackle, and he's always falling forward. And this offense with a bunch of Division I receivers and a Division I quarterback is building itself around Nolan James. Like, there's got to be something here. And then when I sat down and talked to him the other week, and he was talking about his diet and four eggs and two Greek yogurts and turmeric, and I'm like, all right, like, this
JD Bertrand played running back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just like, I don't think it raises your ceiling necessarily. Like, he's not going to become Bijan Robinson because of his diet, but I think he's going to get every last drop out of his potential as a college running back. And so I came out of that last week, and then talking to Jaywan Sider and then Marcus Freeman yesterday, like, I could not be more bullish on Nolan James as a Notre Dame running back than I think I am right now.
Yeah, I agree, Pete. You sat down with him first, and then I came in, and after you left, I talked to him further, and he's very, very impressive. He's exactly what you want in a Notre Dame kid. Hard to believe. Well, he hasn't shown. We don't know yet how good he's going to be, but still hard to believe that he was committed to Boston College for 11 months before Notre Dame took Samson's advice and started recruiting him. But you know, but to keep Marcus Freeman talking about how, you know, wiggle and quick twitch, but the power to, you know, take guys on and break tackles. So again, we talked about this on our previous podcast. Like, we hear all these great things about Nolan James. You saw him in person. I saw film of him, but I mean, in a Notre Dame uniform, seeing him do this. And Tim mentioned the Blue Gold game last year, and I recall the play that, you know, one play in particular that you're talking about. But like, I'm fascinated to see him in action, because we just have not seen a whole lot of him.
We're going to talk a little bit about a point spread that has come out for Notre Dame and the Wisconsin game, but in an effort not to end a segment on a down note, we're going to quickly shift to the transfer portal. There is no podcast jinx this time around. Jalen Harrelson, as speculated by Priester, John Bryce, and I, and as confirmed by Pete Sampson, I think, last week, was going to and has now entered the transfer portal. Pete, you've watched Harrelson a lot because of his time at La Lemire. You're in on this one. Priester and I both love his upside. I thought Notre Dame would get more out of Jalen Harrelson's freshman year, and that is part of the reason, but certainly not all the reason he'll be moving on.
Yeah, I was texting with somebody close to him last week, and he was the sentiment was like, he didn't have a choice in this. You know, Notre Dame is not invested in basketball at a Jalen Harrelson level right now. There are plenty of programs that are invested in basketball to afford Jalen Harrelson. Notre Dame's just not one of them by choice. So I get it. It's unfortunate. I think he's, I don't know about him as a pro until he like gets his jump shot in a better place. But as a athlete, finisher, body balance,
free throw
strength,
drawer.
I mean, yeah, he's got all the pro stuff there. So whether he's a great college player for three more years or two more years or one more year, he's going to be really good for somebody next season. And I think eventually he will be on a NBA basketball court at some point in the future.
Yeah. First of all, I want to, Tom Noy from the South Bend Tribune, I think, was probably the first one to indicate. So I do want to shout out to him, because he's on top of that stuff more than all of us. But you know, Marcus Burton and Cole Serta are next. They've told Notre Dame that they're leaving. And so Harrelson, you know, has thrown his name into the portal. There are five right now. There will be seven scholarship players. Logan Imes, Braden Shrewsbury, Brady Kaler, who has chosen to stay. Onaman, the 6'10" center, who was sidelined this year with an injury. And then the three recruits, Sanderson, who's looked some of the stuff we've seen. Pete, you saw him in person.
Yes.
Some of the stuff we've seen of him on highlight tapes is pretty spectacular. And then Salongo, the center, who's a project, and Nick Shrewsbury, you know, that's seven. So they need five or six transfers. They need starters.
Well, I was going to say they need starters.
They need a starting center. I mean, unless you're going to throw Tommy Onaman in there after having sat out his true freshman year. they're in a world of trouble. And but you know, I mean, even in Burton being hurt obviously throws a wrench into everything from this past season. But like, I can't. I've said it too many times. I think it. I think there's a lack of leadership at the top, and I think it's a poorly coached team. And you can bring in, you're going to bring in transfers. You're going to get bodies, and there'll be some guys that'll have an opportunity to start in the ACC that wouldn't have had a chance to start somewhere else. But what are you going to have at the end of the day?
Yeah, we have to let the portal. I mean, just commenting on what Notre Dame's going to have next year, we're going to have to wait for the portal to play out. But they have to do better than they ever have. And they have to have a portal year, a portal session that is as good as their last five portal years when you take the best players out of it. You don't need Paul Atkinson to compete. You need Paul Atkinson, Cormac Ryan, Dan Miller, and Scott Martin to compete in this portal. That is what you need. You need to have a new team that doesn't...
Ryan Humphrey. Can we get a Ryan Humphrey too?
I mean... Braden Shrewsbury can help you off the bench. You need a new team. Yeah. Brady Kohler will probably should develop into a starting player next year. It's just you.
Which is not going to happen. Like, that's just not going to happen. They're not invested in basketball in a way that you're going to get that kind of class. So, unfortunately, I think if, you know, the way Notre Dame is managing men's basketball right now, like, next year is kind of a wash already. And it's April 2nd, which is somebody who loves basketball just, frankly, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
And, I'm not trying to let Notre Dame off the hook, but it's still an indictment of the system. The amount of money that's being thrown around to guys that are unproven or some that show promise, it's out of control, and it's not a great situation. Notre Dame and all the other middle of the pack, what's Boston College going to spend on their roster? I just do not like the way college athletics are going, and I can say it's going to implode. I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah, I don't. One thing I push back against. I don't think it's going to implode because this weekend is going to be amazing for college basketball fans.
No, I understand. But when I say implode, I mean I think it's a trickle down effect with baseball and hockey and lacrosse and soccer, and I mean it's going to have a trickle down effect on entire athletic departments that have 26. Sports teams, I think that's what Notre Dame has, 26. The trickle-down effect to college athletics is going to be massive at some point. Texas Tech paid $40 million for the team this year. In 2 years, it'll be $90 million. And where does it all end? It ends by eliminating all those other sports, and now college athletics is nothing like we ever knew it to be.
If you mean other sports, I agree. College football, men's college basketball, and women's college basketball will not suffer because some teams don't have enough money to pay. We're gonna tune into the Final Four and gonna watch all 120, hopefully plus minutes with the overtime period. But it is, I absolutely agree with you that it's gonna kill off.
And I know, like, you know, our readers will say, "I don't give a damn about that sport or that sport." Well, okay, you don't.
That's not your
point. No, you don't. But the thousands of student athletes that care and have been pointing to that since they were a little kid, like I tried to point to it, not that I got a scholarship, good Lord. Well, I did to Indianapolis, but not to Notre Dame. Anyway.
I was gonna say, you really wouldn't know because they're taking away 1.5
scholarship. Yeah.
I could have, what was it? I could have completed my education at Indiana Central, which is now University of Indianapolis, for $7,400, 4 years.
But I chose to go
to Notre Dame, and my mother, God rest her soul, is still making payments on it, I think.
Yeah. We will try to end this segment just for, well, now for all of us and for our listeners and Jack Freeman on a positive note. Tim Priester said that Notre Dame men's basketball is in trouble next year. You know who else might be in trouble, according to DraftKings? Wisconsin. Underdogs of 18.5 points in Lambeau Field. How do you guys feel about that?
I would take Notre Dame.
I would too.
I think Notre Dame's going to have some pretty big point spreads to cover for the first month and a half of the season. It wouldn't surprise me if they covered 5 out of 6.
Yeah, I first saw it. I thought, well, that's kind of high, but I think I was thinking of Wisconsin being Wisconsin.
Ron Dayton is not walking through that door, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it is a neutral site. I think that's a good starting point, but with the preseason hype and everything that goes with it, it will probably go up a little bit.
Yeah. Not to get back to the fighting, Marcus Freeman and Luke Fickell, they're kind of brotherly. I think Marcus Freeman might cross the line with Luke Fickell, the point spread by the end of that game. Yeah.
Remember, until last year when the Irish were 6-6 against the spread, Marcus Freeman's 3-year run was the greatest you could possibly imagine against the point spread. He was a covering machine other than week two. We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Irish Gambler. When did you start seeing and hearing about potential red zone issues last season? Were there rumblings in the spring? Has the jersey scrimmage displayed an accurate representation of what red zone looks like in the regular season? And he mentions he doesn't have an instant recall of what jersey practice chatter was. But when did we kind of hear about this, guys? I think we all can remember a certain weekend.
Yeah, they had that off-campus practice. Was that at school field?
It was at Penn, I believe.
Penn. And I think we had all heard something that effectively the offense went 0 of 8 in goal-to-goal situations. So that was the sort of the first, like, all right, that's not good. But it, or the defense is great. You know, and then lo and behold, what did we hear throughout the August? The defense is fantastic. Offense is strong, is coming along. First two games of the season, the offense plays well. Defense is a disaster. So certainly not everything you hear in the offseason or preseason or camp carries over to the jersey scrimmage. I would have a hard time picking out a revelation from a jersey scrimmage other than Sam Hartman a few years ago. Because we mentioned Javonte Jean-Baptiste's spring practice, like, oh, guy really didn't do anything. Sam Hartman was kind of a mess in his spring practice until the jersey scrimmage, where he was very good, and then he was very good again in the spring game, and I think Tyler Buchner transferred 48 hours later. So there are, I would say, like, the jersey scrimmage is probably more of an individual.
Yeah.
Like, in, it's sort of like shines the light on individuals opposed to, like, team themes, if that makes sense.
Didn't Notre Dame finish 21st in the country in red zone touchdown percentage last year? Did they not? They did. I know they did.
Yeah, I guess maybe we should swap out red zone with short yardage. Though,
when they played teams that were bad on defense?
Yeah, I mean, they could have feasted on those teams a little bit more.
In red zone, they were better, Tim, but in goal to go, they struggled all year. I have every stat.
Right, yeah, and you pointed that out. Yeah, you pointed that out as it was happening. C.J. Carr's accuracy a couple years ago in the jersey scrimmage, the two throws to the tight end, that stands out to me. But were you there? You were there, Pete, weren't you?
I mean, I was there for the C.J. Clark one. The
press box view is just like, okay, this has got to be pinpoint.
Yeah.
Two of them. This has got to be pinpoint. And it was they were absolutely pinpoint. Those are two that stand out to me.
Jordan Clark was excellent, and I'd never seen him do a single thing, and he was hurt the whole spring. And he had been hurt his whole Arizona State career, and there was still the lingering doubt that he would be physical enough to play nickel. And the first three plays, I think he was involved in two tackles for loss. I'm like, all right, there's Jordan Clark. That's the Jordan Clark we were told they were getting. So it is guys like that will flash. Greathouse was great as a freshman. In the jersey scrimmage, that was fantastic.
You know, like 12 catches or something?
Yeah, a bunch of short ones, but he was carving out space and getting and receptions.
He started off high. I mean, he had two touchdowns to start his career in the game. So, that's a good point that it is individuals, I think, that we look for in the jersey scrimmage. Teams, they can't run through everything because they wouldn't open it up to us. So they run through stuff, but it's not the most specific stuff I think that they're trying to use. Now, there's no television camera, so you don't have a photographic memory to write down what you saw, and they don't really allow it. There's no cameras involved at all for that, right? Not even the first, but there's no periods. They don't even allow TV cameras for that one. They could run through a lot of stuff. Next question is a two-parter. We're going to start with Tim Priester on this because we've talked about this a few times in the offseason. From R. Kenny Irish 1, Tim has frequently mentioned that the next step in Carr's development is to improve his physical strength. Have you seen any early signs or progress here in terms of like weight increase or a visible difference in person? Let's take that part first because I like the second part separately.
No, I haven't seen any difference there. And when I brought it up to CJ Carr about, you know, pocket presence, and Pete, I had said in a previous podcast that when he got flushed last year, a lot of times the play was over because he couldn't get turned and his shoulders square to the line of scrimmage and to throw the football down the field. He felt it was more he just needed more practice reps with the one under those circumstances, with the first unit under those circumstances, and he had to split those with Kenny Minchie throughout August. So he, like, when I asked that question, it was more about, hey, I just need to rep these more, and I'll be better at it. But I don't see a physical difference. We can talk about it a little bit more in the second question of this, Tim. But, you know, I mean, I think it's football. It behooves everybody to get stronger. Even if, you know, I know Joe Montana wasn't necessarily really strong. It's a different game now, man. You got to play.
He was fast, though. That's one thing, too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I just think it would be better for him in the long run, in the short term as well, with a stronger frame.
I feel like I definitely noticed the difference from his freshman year, though. To me, yeah, he looks bigger. And I think the mobility part, moving in the pocket, it's, you know, it's interesting you mentioned getting flushed from the pocket and the play ending, because the day we talked to him, he stayed after practice to work a throw where he got flushed from the pocket and he threw back across his body to Cooper Flanagan. You know, I think that the strength part for me, the most important strength part for CJ Carr is somebody like Boubacar Traore is coming around the edge and gets a hand on his shoulder and he can shrug it off and still make a play. That's the kind of strength that's important to me if I'm Mike Dembrock.
Totally agree. That's what I mentioned in December as a, we're going to get this question every week, so we'll do it every month. Okay, if you guys are cool with that, we're going to get this question every single week. We'll answer it every month. Jimmy Clausen, even as a junior, would get grabbed and go down. Brady Quinn would get grabbed and not know the guy was there. You got to be somewhere in between. You can't get grabbed and go down. You can't be spinning out of trouble in the pocket. That's just not what's taught. Yeah, if he can eschew some hand grabs and get out of that, I think that's the key. Another part of this development, and I don't know where this is going to go, we're going to have to ask Mike Dembrock because I see both sides. Canadian Invasion says the QB power sneak seems like the most effective way to gain a yard. Statistically, you are correct, Canadian Invasion. At the same time, the season hinges on CJ Carr's health. Do you expect to see Carr carrying the ball? Or will we see something else separately? Is there a Mitchell Palooza?
Do you ever see a quarterback get hurt on a quarterback sneak?
I don't see it either.
I mean, that really, because you're just kind of burrowing into the pile. I imagine it could happen, but I mean, not really. That's where I just think overall strength not only benefits him, but benefits his football team. Candidates for Mitchell Palooza. I mean, does it have to be
a high school quarterback? Remember, that's what made that a very easy transition for Mitchell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. No doubt. I don't know. I thought of James Flanagan right away. I would think Cooper Flanagan, but when you want Cooper Flanagan as a lead blocker handing the ball off to somebody, I think. But look, you got to be able to. He's got to be able to get that yard. Riley, we got spoiled by Riley Leonard. He could get 4 yards. You go third and four and let Riley Leonard plow forward, and that may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's so diametrically opposed to what Riley Leonard was.
I just need him to be able to pick up a yard against BYU and Miami.
That's a good point.
I do not need CJ Carr quarterback sneak in the 10 other games.
Nolan James and Aeneas Williams can pick up that yard.
Yeah.
And he can throw a pass too.
It's like for literally like 9 of the games, you can tell the other team what you're doing and you should still be able to pick it up. And maybe
at USC to end the year is the other one, Pete, right?
That's
the other one.
Yes. Syracuse should be able to just snap it to Nolan James. So yeah, I just need an all hands on deck. Like I need Carr quarterback sneak in the playbook for BYU and Miami, and then you can bring it back in the playoff.
Speaking of all hands on deck, from Bobby 1556, it seems pretty unanimous from the ND beat that when healthy, Charles Jagusa is the best lineman on the roster. Considering he's only really played 2.5 games in his 3-year career, what have you guys seen to come to that conclusion?
I mean, look, I remember talking to Mike Dembrock before the season in 2024, asking about like, hey, who's had a good summer? And he's like, I love our young tackles. And it was Charles Jagusa number one and Emil Wagner number two. The coaches freaking love Charles Jagusa when he's healthy. He just hasn't been healthy. So it's just a shame what's happened to him, because healthy, he was a potential 3-and-out player. He's just is a athletic marvel and he just has not been healthy enough to show it.
Obviously, we do a lot of film reviews at Irish Illustrated, and loved his high school film. You know, he's an offensive guard with offensive tackle skills. I mean, a very powerful player.
Heavyweight wrestler.
Heavyweight wrestler, yeah. Which you love. Marcus Freeman loves wrestlers, referring to Nolan James's family. His brother will be at Penn State this coming year. But, you know, the feet and the base and the strength and the wide base and the athleticism doing it, they're not really built alike. I don't know. But I think of Aaron Taylor.
That's who I think of as Aaron
when
Taylor.
When I see him, it's just the athleticism with the size and the strength and the wide base. You love it. You love an offensive line with a wide base playing with real power. I think we saw that immediately, but he's had five surgeries, and what kind of player will he be after five surgeries? I don't think we're really in a position to speculate that.
I spoke to Joe Rudolph before the national championship game, and remember he had to insert Charles Jagasa because Anthony Knapp got hurt. That's what happened. Anthony Knapp got hurt. They had to move. They put Tosh Baker there. Rocco Spindler was hurt also against Georgia. He was out. Charles Jagasa had to play. He said, after all that Jagasa hadn't played since the Sun Bowl, he goes in against that defense on Penn State, and he said, you could put a teach tape up of how to play offensive guard. And he wasn't playing guard. He was a left tackle in camp. That's insane. And then they asked him to play left tackle against Ohio State, and he did well. I don't know what else we could say about why we think Charles Jagasa is the best player on the best offense.
He's good.
No, we don't know.
No, it's a fair question. Trying to understand the components of what we think we see.
Yeah.
And it's a combination of all everything we just said here. We have a question from Maltese Irish. Besides the obvious QB2, could you each name a backup you consider most valuable to Notre Dame's national title aspirations remaining realistic if he is called upon to take over a starting role?
This was a weird thought exercise because I just wrote down all the positions.
Yeah.
And I sort of went yes or no. Every position on defense was a yes, and every position on offense was a no. Because I like Nolan James, for example, but then it's like you have to have two running backs, and I'm not sure I like RB3.
And so you're saying, yeah, if you lose Faison, you still have good receivers, but you lost the guy that you really need. And if you lose Violet Graham, you lost that guy that's different, right?
I think their number four, number five, number six receivers probably will be pretty good. But I think that Faison and Mylon Graham in particular will be so far ahead that flipping in somebody else, you're going to lose. Tight end, no. Offensive line, no. But then it's like Keon Keeley and Rodney Dunham. Teon Gray and Elijah Hughes. KVA, technically. Jalen Snead, sort of.
He's the one you come back with, KVA.
You know, Dallas Golden. I mean, is Christian Gray a starter? Probably. I mean, then like Joey O'Brien is a reach because we've never seen him, but I don't think he's that big of a reach.
Maybe if you're saying they have two centers they could win the playoff with.
Yeah, I just look at an offensive line.
Yeah, like Craig. I mean, if Otting has a good start and Craig comes in. Yeah. It is a fascinating question. I think they'd be fine on defense. Leonard Moore would probably ruin a late playoff game if you didn't have Leonard Moore and you had a regular human there and you had to play you had to help out that human being on that side of the field during the game. I think that would be a tough one.
But it's funny, you think back to 2 years ago, it's like, well, they're going to lose Anthony Knapp and have to put in Tosh Baker. Like, well, that's it.
Yeah.
Actually, they won the game.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's, I did it on Monday Musings. There's an indispensable myth out there. Teams, there's very few guys you cannot lose. CJ Carr on this team would be one you cannot lose, of course. Yeah. But last year, CJ Carr, Kenny Minchie would have won the last 10 games, 9 of the 10. Maybe USC would have, actually, Carr played poorly against USC. I mean, Kenny Minchie could have won the last 10 games for Notre Dame.
Yes. I guess the question is like, are we talking about the regular season making the playoff, or are we talking about winning in the playoff?
Yeah. Regular season, probably Tim Priester, you'd say most guys can be replaced.
Yeah, that's why my pick is Jaden Sanders, who I think will back up Leonard Moore. And I loved what I saw of him at Michigan. He was like the seventh or eighth cornerback in camp and ended up starting a couple games in late September, I think it was. I like what I've seen of him on the practice field, just his length. You know, him and Christian Gray both are long leg, high hip, kind of shorter torso guys, which is a really great build for a corner. And they're both listed at 6'0", I think, but Sanders looks taller and longer. So he's the guy that I think would be a real key there. Dellis Golden is, I think, you know, Dellis Golden, it's going to be very interesting to see what they do at nickel and corner with McKinney not here yet. I mean, we've assumed that McKinney's going to step into the starting lineup, and so that's why.
I don't know about that. I just think they're going to have a heavier rotation now, Tim. Aside from Leonard Moore.
Well, and that's great. You need to do that. It's just that, you know, McKinney's played 40 games and was pretty highly touted going into last year. And I don't, you know, I think the whole Colorado team didn't live up to whatever expectations were. But yeah, Tim, I think that's if you can get into that situation where you can rotate a little bit and keep guys fresh, somebody was it mentioned about Christian Gray? I mean, he was beaten down, but he had to stay in the USC game.
Yeah.
If you can get, you know, this is such a rotational game now. That's why you say, you know, backup. Well, I mean, second teamers are co-starters really at a lot of positions both sides of the ball, with the exception of the offensive line, of course. So great question. But Jaden Sanders is the first one that comes to mind for me, because Leonard Moore's tremendous. Sanders would do a decent job of bridging the gap, but Leonard Moore's Leonard Moore.
Yes, Pete Sibbs, don't have it be against Malachi Toney, and you can bring in Jaden Sanders or DJ McKinney and Christian Gray and do just fine. Switching gears here quickly, Jack Brophy, longtime subscriber. I actually talked about this with my son. I have wanted to know this for several years, he asks. Why does men's college basketball have two halves while literally every other level of basketball, NBA, WNBA, NCAA women, high school, junior high, and AAU, use quarters? Can anyone enlighten Jack Brophy?
I can't.
Not easy chat GPT search, if you guys are wondering.
Oh, I didn't look. No, I didn't look. I figured you already had the answer.
I have a question.
I have no idea. Somebody has an answer here?
You use that question, you don't have the answer.
You're supposed to have answers too, Tim Priester. You read the question, you get the answer.
I wasn't supposed to be on the podcast today.
I changed this so you could have a basketball question. I eliminated the baseball question when we lost.
All right, well, it's up to our listeners to enlighten us.
No, yeah. All right. So according to a ESPN article in 2015, I did not realize that women went to quarters in 2015. I thought it was longer than that. There's a reason I don't know that. We won't get into, but I did not know that. According to something to do with the timeouts and how they like the TV timeouts, there's always pushback against this, enough pushback for the rules committee not to change how men's basketball is done. But it's literally a rule just back from Naismith. And in 1954, they had quarters and they went right back to having halves. And the most angry person about this is not Jack Brophy or us. It's Jay Billis, who just went on a rant about how in the world you don't have quarters for college basketball. I assume they'll have quarters for college basketball, but you know what's more important for me? That they put the names on the jerseys for the blue-gold game.
I didn't realize they were in the same realm.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you love that? And wouldn't fans love it? And then you could sell all those jerseys and make NIL money and support your basketball team.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah,
that'd be great. That would be NIL money the real way right there, if you put names on the jerseys for the blue-gold game. And while we're at it, the jersey scrimmage, too, I think would be good for us, but I don't think they're going to do that. Question from Annie Davis, too. What is the ceiling for Aeneas Williams as a pass-catching back? And which is the biggest factor in that equation? Aeneas himself, CJ Carr, or Mike Dembrock? Then there's a piggyback answer that timed out well since you did join the podcast, Tim Priester.
Oh, you're going to wait on that one? Okay. Well, the ceiling for the biggest factor in the equation, Aeneas Williams is an adept receiver, so it's you know, he would be last as to why he wouldn't be a bigger factor. You know, it can be called by Denbrock, it can be checkdowns for CJ Carr. That's kind of a toss-up for me between those two. I'd say more Denbrock.
I agree. I think if Denbrock wants to get him involved, it would happen. Enough.
Yeah.
Pete Sampson.
Yeah, I tend to lean towards Carr because, like, the running back is usually out in a pass formation, pass route anyway. I think that's pretty common. Like, it's not all the time, but you know, maybe you throw the offensive line in there too. Like, if the offensive line is really like humming, then with Cooper Flanagan, then you can probably send your running back out more often. But I think Carr will sort of see everything, and if the defense isn't flowing to Aeneas Williams, then the ball is coming to Aeneas Williams, and that will be a CJ Carr thing more than anybody else.
Tim, are you going to say something?
Well, I was just going to get to the second question. You want me to go ahead?
I want to say I think it's on Denbrock because I think Freeman might have dropped a little hint when I asked him about Nolan James. Could he contrast Nolan James with Aeneas Williams? And he goes, "You all know we can take Aeneas Williams and split him out and get him out of the backfield and catch passes." I don't think he said that because they haven't been doing that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Not. And Williams' reputation precedes him as a pass catcher. We all remember Penn State, but I think he's shown that he's good at it. The second question from Pasty Pants: who's the best pass catching back you've seen at Notre Dame? I can go way back. Does Darius Walker hold the record?
Yeah.
For a season?
Yeah. The 56 catches. 50, and
yeah.
He's the most adept at it. Like, he's just naturally good at the
Yeah, he had 109 in his career.
Yeah.
In 3 years.
Mostly in 2 years, too, I bet. I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. It was teens, I think.
Yeah, he had 99 in 2 years.
Yeah, there you go.
And again, like, what was the common denominator there? He had a really good quarterback to get on the ball.
Yeah.
I mean, Armando Allen had 50 catches in, I think, 2008. So it's.
That might have been not being able to run.
Yeah, I would. That's extension of the running game stuff. But Darius Walker's would probably be the best. I mean, he was just really good at screens, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, that's not really an out of the backfield thing, but it's a big part of, you know, where you can do your damage as a back.
It's definitely not the extension of the running game, but I can go back. That's a joke. You guys are supposed to remember what I'm talking about there. Bob Gladio, who played in the mid to late 60s, I believe he was the second leading receiver on the team in 68.
Wow, that's a,
he was
Bob, a successful team, too.
Yeah,
so as like a, the old Armando thing. Yeah,
and as a sophomore, he scored the lone touchdown against Michigan State in the 10-10 tie. But he had 37 receptions his senior year in 68. I immediately thought of him because I knew that, and I don't know how much running backs caught the ball. I'm not sure, but as a young Notre Dame fan, I remember Bob Gladio, and then got to know him quite well in my adult years.
So we mentioned Darius, and he's the volume guy. Theo Riddick was tremendous.
Oh, tremendous! Yes,
and he was kind of the straw that stirred the offense's somewhat sour drink in 2012. But Theo Riddick was great at it. He made a career out of it. And then who would have been the best if they needed it? Would have been Ricky Waters, because clearly, if you can exclude the NFL, Ricky Waters is 10 times better than all these guys at catching the ball in the backfield, because he made a NFL career out of also catching the ball in the backfield. But he was not, other than when he played flanker, he didn't throw many passing the running backs. You didn't have to. You didn't need any extensions of anything.
just hand him the damn ball.
Just hand the ball to that guy and go over there and score touchdowns. That's good. But they've had some good ones, but Theo Riddick, really talented at it, too. I mean, he was
really, really good. We have a question from Kay Beasley. Staff seems high on Flanagan and Flanagan, Cooper and James, as being a potential upgrade for the overall tight end unit. What's stopping Ian Premer from being a contributing tight end? And could he beat Kyle Rudolph's freshman season of 29 catches, 340 yards, and 2 touchdowns? He's not going to beat Michael Mayer.
Yeah.
They're not going to run enough
personnel
for that to happen.
No. You know, Premer would have to come in and probably beat out both Flanagans to put up a stat line like that, which I guess I would never rule out entirely. I just think it's really unlikely. I also would push back a little bit on, like, the upgrade of the tight end position because Eli Raritan is going to be playing in the NFL. So I like Cooper Flanagan a lot. I think he'll be tight end one. I think Ian Premer will get on the field this year, but 29 catches for 340 yards and 2 touchdowns seems like too much.
I think there's too many guys catching passes for him to have that stat line. Part of the reason, now Rudolph played on a talented team, but they couldn't run in 2008, going back to it. And that's why he had to catch passes. He's also the only tight end. He was literally the only tight end. Conrad Roiland transferred. Mike Ragone got hurt. Names you did not expect to hear on this podcast.
But I think Will Yeatman had two catches that year.
Will Yeatman, yeah. And did he get, when was he suspended? He came back.
I don't know. I don't know. But that I was devastated when Will Yeatman was not eligible. I thought he could do some real, seriously, I thought he could do some really, really good things. But look, there are too many wide, talented wide receivers for this to be a heavy tight end. And tight end, yeah. Right, exactly. And tied in with the fact that Eli Raritan was a very good catcher of passes, receiver. Cooper Flanagan has never had the reputation of a catcher of passes. And then Denbrock, the last time we talked to him, talked about like they threw the ball to James Flanagan like 11 times or 16 times in high school. So he doesn't have a lot of experience doing that, which is why Premer's a guy in a position to end up with the most catches among the tight ends.
On the positive, if you're looking for him to have, let's say not 29 catches, but four touchdowns, there's that huge advantage. If he has four touchdowns, that's a giant red zone add, and it's also four more than Eli Raritan had last year, as the joke goes. But Gino Gadulli, I asked him about Notre Dame's passing game, and he mentioned people, and he actually mentioned Ian Premer without me asking about Ian Premer, and he is not here. I asked about CJ Carr. CJ Carr working with new guys. And he's like, I'm not too worried about it. Everybody's here. Ian Premer's not here. I was like, oh.
But we'll see. We'll see way more 11 personnel than we've seen in recent years.
Yeah. Our next question, Pete's going to have to answer this one first, is from Bo Scarborough's burner. I don't know if you knew you were going to be on today or not, Pete Sampson. But speaking of devastated with Will Yeatman, I'm sure there's some devastation with Pete Sampson and Bo Scarborough. Real position battles versus coach speak position battles. Go.
Not many real ones. I mean, we were texting about this. It's a coach speak one that came to mind immediately was Marcus Freeman talking about the tight ends yesterday, and it'd be like, oh, you know, it's too soon to name Cooper Flanagan, like, and then I'm going to list every other tight end. But then he did say, like, we think Coop's really special. So it's like, even by the end of the paragraph, Freeman was like, nobody's buying this.
Figure no one's going to believe him anymore.
Yeah, it's weird how few position battles there actually are.
It's rotations, too.
Yeah, I think the timeshare has a lot to do with that. But there really aren't. Christian Gray and Dallas Golden at nickel. You know, tight end is a fight for a spot on the field.
Yeah, there's spots on the field fights. That's a great point. Will you actually play, or are you going to play 57 snaps this year when we thought you might play? Yeah.
Who's the sixth receiver feels like an actual position battle.
Right. Like,
interesting. Like, in the realm of position battles, WR6 is not like high in the list of stories.
Even nickel, they're going to use them both.
Yeah.
They're going to use them both. And as I said, they're going to use three when Miami comes to town. They're going to use two of the other rest of the games, and they're going to put somebody else at nickel when Miami comes to town. It's such a heavy rotation. They want it to be that way now. And I don't think there's a huge position battle at right guard with Abisher and Mighty Augustine. I just think Sullivan Abisher will do the job and win the job.
No, but Augustine's number six.
Yeah.
Well, number seven, because Ashton Craig's out at center right now.
Somebody has asked me, I'm going to research this. This is as an aside, but quickly. I guess I remember Ashton Craig playing a guard when he was younger in any of those camps when they shuffled people. Basically, the question was, if Joe Otting does great, would Ashton Craig be able to help you at guard too, type thing?
I mean, I don't know for sure, but it's kind of like vaguely he did.
Yeah.
Did he come in as a center? I don't know that I remember.
I just know remember it that way exactly. For sure, a lot in 23, which takes you way back, right? I mean, he came in at Clemson and did well at center as the third center. There's a third center.
That's right. Yeah.
That's something to look up in your old practice reports, Pete Sampson. All right, good question here from Shibe43. The culture of this program has been brought up multiple times in interviews by both freshmen and incoming transfers. Is there another time on the beat where you guys were able to feel or see tangible effect of program culture? And here's the best part, either positively or negatively.
I mean, I keep going back. I know everyone likes to talk about Marcus Freeman's culture, and he does a really good job of that. However, I keep going back to when he got hired and Jack Swarbrick talking about the program culture being something the players owned under Brian Kelly. And that's why he hired Marcus Freeman, because the culture was so good already. So that's like the one thing that really sticks out to me, is like the athletic director holding that up independent of the head coach, entirely independent of the head coach, the outgoing one or the incoming one, as something that was important about what was going on at Notre Dame. So that's sort of where I remember like culture being referenced the most, and it really kind of having some teeth to it.
Marcus Freeman's the seventh head Notre Dame head football coach that I've covered. So, I mean, the two eras where it was clearly negative was Jerry Faust and Bob Davie. Mm-hmm. The players didn't, in a different way, the players didn't respect Jerry Faust, and that occurred pretty early in the process, and they kept him 5 years. Bob Davie, I think he was too erratic in his dealings with the players. And so, it was pretty easy to sense that then. And so somebody may say, what about Tyrone Willingham? No, because I think the players respected Tyrone Willingham.
Yes.
They were up in arms when he was fired in 2004.
Yeah, he was a professional, and he treated them like, you know, young men, young adults. And so that was different in the last 2 years. But it was clear that, I mean, I know there are a lot of people that said, you know, what a great man Jerry Faust was, but he was so far over his head, it was unreal. And really, Bob Davie was too. He wasn't ready for that position at all.
This culture in 16 was bad enough that Brian Kelly talked about it thereafter. 2016 was awful. Some things were out of his control, health with his assistants, but Brian Van Gorder being brought back and being fired in right there in the middle of it. And speaking of not knowing how to relate to student athletes, you mentioned that of Brian Van Gorder before. He didn't relate to student athletes. When I was a senior, 94's culture was an absolute train wreck, but Lou Holtz got that under control for 95. That's why there were fights on buses to bowl games, and the linebacker had more fights at it. And I don't mean the football position, the linebacker. I meant Thursday nights. So that was a mess. The 2011 Brian Kelly team turned it around when they had the big, you could see the guys I've recruited thing, when we thought they could start losing again because of that. But that team, knowing from a famous baby Hall of Fame player, talked about the leftover guys from Weiss way too much, commiserating with Weiss to the point it was to the detriment of Brian Kelly's team in 2011. That is a bad culture. And then all of a sudden, 2012, offensive linemen take over the culture with Harry Hiestand forever, and you've never heard anything about bad culture again other than 16. I mean, Zach Martin and the offensive line culture has almost survived 14 years passing it on. They really have a great program culture. Brian Kelly said after 16, when we asked him what went wrong, he's like, I leaned on talent more than, I don't know if he used the word culture, but I leaned on talent more than I did teamwork, more than I did on doing the right
thing. Yeah, and he did try to engage his players more, whether it came off as completely genuine or not. I think he made some inroads there. Weiss was just such a unique personality, a guy that really never took responsibility for the problems that they had. It was always somebody else's fault, whether it was in the administration or otherwise, and that's just who the man is.
All right, final question, and I promise, see, we're going to end on a happy note. This one's from our buddy Phil at One Foot Down, an homage to a long-standing question from 2021 involving Diggs and Colsey. I needed to have you two on the podcast for this one, if you remember this one, Tim Priester. What happens first, Nolan James, 150 all-purpose yards in a game, or a Quincy Porter touchdown, or a Cam Williams touchdown?
Okay, third would be a Cam Williams touchdown, because at best he's number three on the depth chart at W receiver. I mean, I would think Aeneas Williams would be more likely to have 150 yards all-purpose.
I think that's why Norlin James is the sneaky person he wrote in here. That's Phil from One Foot Down.
Exactly. But again, not having seen Norlin James do this in a Notre Dame football uniform, I'm going to place him number two, and Quincy Porter will be sharing that W position with Micah Gilbert, and would be an inviting target in Lambeau Field against Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think I'll go Porter I might even go Cam Williams 2 and then Nolan James 3. As much as I love Nolan James, 150 yards is a lot.
All right, so here's some logic. I'm going to break this down for you. I might go Cam Williams 2. Who was the number one W receiver last year? Boundary wide receiver. You guys remember? Good player.
Yeah, it's Malachi Fields.
Malachi Fields, right? Number two is Micah Gilbert. Who scored the first touchdown of the season for Notre Dame? The number two W receiver, Micah Gilbert, at Miami from CJ Carr. So I'm going Quincy Porter, number one. Who do they play in week two? Rice. Cam Williams. Touchdown number seven on the day for the Fighting Irish. Nolan James picks up 150 yards somewhere in North Carolina because those guys don't like tackling Notre Dame running backs or quarterbacks, if you're listening. They couldn't tackle Ian Book either.
And we've heard a Deion McIntosh performance at North Carolina.
Deion McIntosh. We've heard Nolan James is hard to tackle. So here we go. But Quincy Porter is my pick. That's the one. I do love this old question, Diggs Colsey. By the way, Diggs ended up winning it, right? He had to have. Was 150 yards for Diggs? No, it was 100 yards. They never used to get 100 yards. Running.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's what the bet was.
Or a Colsey touchdown.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going Quincy Porter. You guys too?
Yep.
Yeah, Porter's the pick.
Notre Dame is on Easter break. I don't know if they practice Monday or not, but they definitely don't practice on Good Friday. You did mention they'd be going.
They probably don't practice Monday.
Probably got to get on there Monday.
We don't know exactly what Notre Dame's schedule is. We know what days we have access to watching practice and or having interviews. We do know that they are at the number six. They've completed six practices.
So it'll either be number seven or eight when we are let inside the walls for practice next week, middle of next week, to be vague. And then that's only four periods, not the full scrimmage. And then the jersey scrimmage is, of course, a week before the Blue Bowl game. Until next week, for Pete Sampson, The Athletic, Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.